we are very honoured and indebted to Desmond for him to be able to come here today, because he no longer lives in London and he's got a long way to travel. And I would just merely end up with those few words and welcome Mr. Desmond Greaves, editor of the Irish Democrat and well-known historian.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I scarcely recognise myself, you know, in that very nice encomium which Chris bestowed upon me. And, of course, I see when I look at the agenda that I'm supposed to give you a talk on the life and times of Brontë O'Brien. Well, now, to do that would require, on the one hand, more time than you're likely to have to spare. Likewise, it would require more qualifications than I possess. So I have to apologise for not fulfilling the bill as it's set out. It occurred to me, however, that I might make one or two observations. And the first one that occurs to me is the way in which cataclysmic events can dominate the political life of a whole generation. Such a cataclysmic event was the French Revolution of the year 1789. And I'm going to say a little more about it later on, if you have the patience. 2 years' time, we have the bicentenary of the French Revolution in 1989. And I'm wondering what the French will make of it. I'll just leave it at that for the moment. I'm wondering what the French will make of it. But the French Revolution dominated the whole period for 50 years after 1789. It was a measure of everybody's opinions. If we take a parallel in our own time, the Russian Revolution took place in one day in 1917, and world politics has been about that since then. Mr. President Reagan can think of nothing else, and if you want to know anybody's position, you determine it in relation to that event. And it was Wolfe Tone in Ireland who commented that the minute that the French Revolution took place, that became the measure of every man's politics. And he said, I don't need to say, he said, of course, that I was a Democrat from the start. The world was divided into Democrats and aristocrats. Now, this was true of Ireland. And it was particularly true of the County Longford. Now, I can see one or two Longford men round here today, and so I've got to be very careful what I say about Longford. But it is a fact that Brontë O'Brien, or James O'Brien, he was born, in Granite in the County Longford. And he was born in 1804. And the attempt to introduce the rights of man into Ireland had been undertaken by the United Irishmen, who became a rebellious or revolutionary organisation from 1895. And so, all round where he was brought up, there were people who remembered such events as the Castlebar races, when the English were driven helter-skelter and had great difficulty recuperating themselves. And I think I'm right in saying that some of the rebels were accumulated in the County Longford, and I'm not sure, I may be committing a lie, but I understand that one of Pat Bunn's ancestors gave them some little surreptitious support. But I leave him to confess to that, if it's true. But that was the thing, the French Revolution, and we want to remember what it brought. It was the introduction of democracy. It had never previously been thought that political power depended on the people. The first time. Maybe these sentiments may have been expressed by prophets and seers and so on, practicality. And of course, the landlords were swept away. Admittedly, they got back again, but they were swept away. That old ramshackle feudal edifice that dominated Europe, the Holy Roman Empire, that was given a mortal blow. It hung on till 1848. And so there was the background of the birth and surroundings, you see, of the generation to which Brontë O'Brien belonged. And it's therefore not surprising that he should, when he used a nom de plume for his writings, choose a French name, Brontë. I don't know just why he chose that, and I don't know if anybody else does, but it was a pseudonym, an underpin, Brunchak. And he came into politics round about 1830, when there was an attempt at a replay of the French Revolution in France in 1830. And I go on about this because it's vitally important to understand Chartism, to understand the French element that was in it. You see, whole nations were created by the French Revolution. The characteristic flag of a European nation is a tricolour. An Irish tricolour, a Belgian tricolour, a French tricolour. And they all have white in the middle. And the white stands for Jacobinism, because the Jacobins met at the monastery or abbey of St. James's, and white is the colour of St. James. And it's the white in the flag that's the important colour. That's the colour that stands for liberty, equality and fraternity. And among those in the French Revolution, there were a small radical group in whom the names Babur and Buonarroti would be the most famous, who went further than asserting the rights of the people in general to dominate the political scene. They began to assert the rights of labour. And it was in the appalling conditions that existed in Ireland after the defeat of the Rising of 1798 and the disappointment of Emmet's Rising in 1803, and those appalling conditions in which people were driven back into almost animal poverty, that James O'Brien learned to be a radical. And when he came to Britain, he began to put some of these ideas into force. Of course, the greatest first episode of his revolutionary career was the fighting for a free press. You know, John Milton wrote a pamphlet, the name of which I think is Areopagitica, and it was a plea for the freedom of unlicensed printing. That would be about 1649, or round about that period. And 200 years nearly had gone by, and you couldn't publish a working class newspaper without putting a sixpenny stamp on it. And that was when a pound was a pound, you know. We don't think much about it. If you dropped a sixpence here, you probably wouldn't bother to look for it. But in those days, it was a big sum of money. And it was Brunchak O'Brien who became the first editor of that famous Chartist paper, The Poor Man's Guardian. And it was an illegal paper. Now, they talk about running around with the Irish Democrats, stuffed up your jersey, I don't know. But what it was then with the Poor Man's Guardian, they went to jail in droves. There were simply, there'd be hundreds in jail at one time for the crime of selling a paper that hadn't got a sixpenny stamp on, or whatever value stamp they had to add. And this was ultimately the typical English compromise. They got round it by passing a, it wasn't a law, it was a judgment in a court, that the Poor Man's Guardian couldn't really strictly be regarded as being a newspaper, and therefore, not being a newspaper, it didn't require a stamp, and so they gave in. It was impossible to do anything else about it. Now, of course, the later time, of course, O'Brien was very active in the petition for the People's Charter. Now, a lot of people don't know the origin of the word Chartism, and of course, now, it was Daniel O'Connell who gave the word Chartism to the world. Daniel O'Connell, at the time of Catholic Emancipation in 1829, was a bit of a radical himself. And he met the Chartist leaders, and he drafted the 6 points, 6 points of the Charter. And it did not then include the independence of Ireland. That was added by Fergus O'Connor as a 7 point at a later date. But Dan says to, I forget who it was, Lovett, I think, well, there's your Charter. And they became the Chartists. But the actual programme the Chartists had was the programme of the United Irishmen that was drafted in 1795, the exact points, and the aim of the whole thing was universal suffrage, and if there was universal suffrage, they naturally assumed that there would be democracy. And so the struggle went on, and the fight for the People's Charter reached its highest pinnacle in 1839, but again there was struggle in 1848. Now, I don't want to stop without making a reference to the later part of Ronsard O'Brien's life. He was a great teacher. He was an educated man, a lawyer. He went to Trinity College, Dublin, threw on his lot with the working class and suffered very grievously, financially, because of that. He was a man who was particularly interested in the radicals of the French Revolution, particularly Barbeuf and Buonarroti. And he made it his business to translate the writings of Buonarroti and to explain the teachings of Barbeuf. And I think it'd be safe to say that of all the Chartist leaders, maybe he hadn't got the flair of Fergus O'Connor. Fergus O'Connor was like old Jim Larkin. He could do anything with a crowd. You'd say Ronsard O'Brien was a more thoughtful man. If you like to compare the two of them, Larkin and Connolly, you had the same picture of O'Brien and O'Connor. And of course, it's an interesting thing that every important position in the Chartist movement was held by Irish people, and even the first grand consolidated trade union was started by Donegal and Doherty. So the Irish were right in the midst of this. And while he stood and taught the principles of the French Revolution, he included in that the right of nations to be independent. And this, of course, is one of the cardinal principles of the French Revolution. Now, I don't want to go on very long, because people here, of course, have got tired ears and thirsty throats, and you don't want to be too long. But I do want to take a couple of things. Firstly, in the last period of O'Brien's life, he continued to be active. He didn't have the tragic end that O'Connor did, because Fergus O'Connor went off his head, and he's buried in Kensal Green Cemetery. I remember we had the grave cleaned some years ago, and the centenary of his death would be in 1955. But he died in obscurity and he died in poverty. That was the fatal. But he kept going all the time. He had this little institute down there in Holborn there, and they used to hold weekly meetings, and they're referred to by Karl Marx. Historically, he stands, so to speak, between Buonarroti and Marx. Marx was born in 1818, O'Brien 1804, and the Chartist writings were, according to Marx's own admission, the means by which he first came into touch with working class socialism. There are numerous Chartist papers. Just think of it. Have we got a single really national Labour paper in this country at the present time? I know there's many worthy attempts. I'm not saying a word against the worthy attempts, but just consider the thing that when the Poor Man's Guardian is sold in thousands and thousands of copies. And here's the mighty Labour movement of today can't produce a really efficient newspaper that can compete on equal terms with the rubbish of Fleet Street. But in those days they could do it. And O'Brien continued in a very dark period after the big circulation had gone, after the Great Chartist movement had somewhat died down, and he never saw the revival. Things can be flat for a long time, you know, before they revive. 1848 was the last sort of spark of Chartism. And the British working class went into what's been referred to as its long sleep. And it woke up in 1889, the London Dock Strike. And nobody could have foreseen it. And that was 25 years after O'Brien was dead before you got any sizable Labour movement. And the other thing I want to say before I get down is, what about the present time? You see, I referred to the French Revolution. And I often give this quotation, but unfortunately I don't know where it comes from. The London Times had a letter written by a noble lord. I'm not quite sure if I libel the name. His name escapes me. I think it was something like Chalfont, some name like that. He's an extremely Tory-minded lord. I mean, not occasional lords at all. This was a real vintage specimen of lordship. And he says, what we've got to do, he says, the task in front of the West. The West, by the way, includes Japan, as you're probably aware. In front of the West, see, is to liquidate the legacy of the French Revolution. Now, I didn't cut it out. I should have done. I didn't even make a note of it, except a mental note. I said, well, that's such a daft proposition. See, it's so impossible and so ridiculous that where did the man get it from? Little did I think, within a very few years, I would see that actually being put into effect. And it's being put into effect at the present time. There is going through the House of Commons at the present time this European bill, which has, in essence, the decision to eliminate nationality, to turn the whole of Europe into one super state, in which everything will be governed from Brussels, and the British people and the Irish people and others will not be able to have their own independent foreign policy, nor will they be able to determine anything of interest. And we're seeing the creation in front of our eyes of a new financial feudalism in which governments have got no power and in which all the important decisions are taken in the boardrooms of transnational companies. And so it's very appropriate that at a time when this is proceeding in front of our eyes, with, I must say, very little resistance in this country, though I'm glad to say there is a certain amount of resistance in Ireland, as I happen to know from being in Dublin a couple of weeks ago, but it's very appropriate that we should remind ourselves that there was a leader of the British working class, an Irishman, Bronte O'Brien, who informed his readers and followers with the democratic principles of the French Revolution. And I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen, that when we have, in 2 years' time, the bicentenary of the French Revolution, then we should have a double event here in which we simultaneously commemorate O'Brien and also commemorate the French Revolution. Don't mean what I give.